Om sahanavavatu sahanau bhunaktu sahavidyan karavavahai tejasvinavadhitamastu mavidvishavahai. Om shanti shanti shantihi. Om. Welcome back. Welcome also to many students attending these classes regularly online. And happy Deepavali to you all, if I haven't already wished you and your family. We will continue today in chapter 15. This is a wonderful section, actually, where Sri Krishna is teaching Uddhava a variety of different spiritual practices, different kinds of sadhana. And what's interesting is that his approach here actually differs slightly from his approach in the Bhagavad Gita. In particular, what's unique about this Uddhava Gita is actually a reflection of its context in the Bhagavata Purana. Bhagavata Purana, of course, is a text that emphasizes bhakti. So, Sri Krishna, in this section, we saw this last week as well, in this section, he creates a hierarchy of these four main spiritual practices, jnana, bhakti, karma yoga, and dhyana, meditation. In the Bhagavad Gita, he doesn't create a hierarchy. This is an important point. We should begin with this. In the Bhagavad Gita, there's no hierarchy. When he's talking about jnanam in chapter 2 and elsewhere, he says jnanam is the best. When he's talking about karma yoga in chapter 3 and elsewhere, he says karma yoga is the best. When he's talking about dhyana, meditation, in chapter 6, he says dhyana is the best. You get the point. So it's very contextual. Which is best, of course, when he's talking about bhakti in chapter 12 and elsewhere. Bhakti is the best. So the approach in the Bhagavad Gita is very clearly based on the principle we've discussed here many times, the principle of adhikari bheda. That is to say that there are different spiritual teachings that are intended for different spiritual aspirants. It's not one size fits all. And that leads to some complexity in the scripture and more complexity in interpretation, but that makes sense because we are complex, right? Any other cell phones can be turned off. So since we are complex, since we are also different by nature, shouldn't we expect the texts to address us in our complexity and not to try to lump us all into one category? That's one of the unique features, I feel, about Vedanta in general, and Vedanta in particular, and the Hindu tradition in general. So in the Bhagavad Gita, where Sri Krishna calls out each one of these four spiritual practices and calls them each one individually the best, here in this chapter, he creates a different kind of hierarchy. He says that the ultimate sadhana is pick one of two, jnana or bhakti. He puts them in a higher rank. He says that jnana and bhakti are the ultimate spiritual practices, but in order to practice jnana and bhakti, you have to be prepared. How do you get prepared? Karma yoga and dhyana. So he creates this hierarchy, and you won't find that hierarchy in the Bhagavad Gita. You will find it here. And then if you say, wait a minute, people love to argue about this stuff. So people will argue, wait a minute, Sri Krishna is contradicting himself? Of course not. Everything taught is always taught in a context. So when Sri Krishna is teaching Arjuna, there's one context. When Sri Krishna is teaching Uddhava, there's another context. Yeah, I don't know. People they call it proofreader's mind, where people look at texts not for the sake of gaining spiritual wisdom, but they read the text for the purpose of finding what's wrong with the text. I don't understand that. You know, what do you hope to get out? It's like when you pick up a book and you start reading it only looking for typos. What do you hope to? How can you enjoy that book? Anyway, you know that some people are like that. I doubt any of you are, but some people are. Okay. So with that in mind, we have a different approach here in the Uddhava Gita, where bhakti and jnana are assigned to a higher rank, and karma yoga and dhyana are considered preparatory for those higher two. So with that introduction, we can pick up the thread. All right, there we go. Manogatim na visrajet, manogatim na visrajet, jita prano jitendriyaha, jita prano jitendriyaha, sattva sampannaya buddhya, sattva sampannaya buddhya, mana atma vasham nayet, atma vasham nayet. Start in the last line. Manas, mind, atma vasham nayet. One should lead the mind to be atma vasham, under one's control. That should sound familiar because Sri Krishna used virtually the same language in the verses we saw last week. So one should control one's mind. The mind should be trained to make it under your control. How? And that's the topic. This is dhyana. The topic is dhyana, meditation. How to train the mind is the topic. And in the next verse, you see a wonderful metaphor. We'll see that in just a moment. First, he begins by making a reference to what we now call the Patanjali Yoga Sutras. He says how, in the second line, he says you should be jitta pranaha. You should have your prana. Here, breath, just simply breath. Other meanings also are there for prana. But you should control your breath, as in pranayama, one of the important preparatory steps of meditation. Pranayama itself can be a powerful meditation technique. So pranayama, jitta pranaha, to control your breathing is one aspect of dhyana. And another is jitta indriya, to control your indriya's senses. Jitta means conquered, one whose senses are conquered, are under control, is jitendriya. Senses include not only your five senses, but your mind in general is considered a sense organ. Some of you know in Patanjali's Yoga Sutras, where he enumerates the ashta anga, the eight limbs, that along with pranayama being one of those limbs, another one is pratyahara. In fact, the immediately succeeding limb is pratyahara, sense withdrawal. So that's what the reference here is to. The practice of pranayama, the practice of pratyahara, sense withdrawal, as part of that practice of dhyana, meditation. And then what? And then keep going. That's in the third line. Manogatim na visrajet. Na visrajet. You shouldn't let go of, you shouldn't abandon manogatim, the goal of quieting your mind, the goal of controlling your mind. And the reason for this particular statement is when you start practicing meditation, when you start practicing pranayama, when you start practicing pratyahara, does your mind immediately become nice and quiet and focused? It doesn't immediately become nice and quiet. It takes time to cultivate these skills. You've heard me say many times, meditation is a learned skill. And it takes time to develop or cultivate any skill, including meditation. So this first line is a reference to the fact that you have to be dedicated and continue to make this effort. Therefore, na visrajet, don't give up. Don't ignore manogatim, the goal of quieting your mind. And you continue this how? In a third line, sattva sampannaya buddhya. This meditation practice is to be understood, buddhya, by a mind, with a mind, I should say, which is sattva sampanna, endowed with sattva. Now, sattva means the sattva, again, different meanings in different contexts. Here it means the very positive traits of a mind, the traits of calmness, the trait of tranquility. These are sattvika gunas. These are good qualities of the mind. How do you cultivate these good qualities? Here we have a little bit of a vicious circle. And that is, you cultivate these qualities through dhyana, but how do you perform dhyana? By first cultivating these sattva. How do you cultivate sattva? By practicing dhyana. How do you practice dhyana? You see the vicious loop. And some people, again, those proofreaders, looking for typos, will object to this as well. And this is, in fact, if they know a little bit of logic, they'll say this is anyonyashrama. Anyonyashraya is the Sanskrit term for the logical defect of mutual dependence. Which comes first, chicken or egg, is the thing. So which comes first, a sattvika mind or meditation, chicken and egg? So the proofreaders will say, aha, anyonyashraya defect. Who said spiritual practice is like a cookbook? You know, people are so accustomed to this cookbook mentality. Do step A, step B, step C, step D. It's not cookbook like that. It's very non-linear. Sometimes we forget how much of our learning, in particular, is non-linear. For example, when you learn a language, do you learn vocabulary first or do you learn grammar first? Huh? You get the point? You don't just learn the grammar first. You don't just learn the vocabulary first. You're going back and forth. There are so many cases where learning and processes in general are non-linear, not cookbook. And that absolutely is true about spiritual practice. So sattva guna is cultivated in parallel with the skill of meditation. But here we have to make an important observation. And we're going to bring in a little the karma yoga we haven't talked about in this context. Let's bring it in right now. Karma, the purpose of karma yoga, I mentioned this, I think, in the prior class, a technical explanation for the role of karma yoga in spiritual life is to manage your raga dvesha. So the first problem one encounters in spiritual life is raga dvesha, and that is your likes and dislikes are pulling you in so many directions. For example, on a Saturday morning, one raga is pulling you to stay in bed instead of coming to class. Well, here's the point. If you don't manage raga and dvesha sufficiently, you won't be very inclined to sit down and meditate, right? So managing raga dvesha, at least to some measure, is an absolute prerequisite for any kind of spiritual practice. Because in the presence of strong raga dvesha, you won't engage in any spiritual practice. There are many more pleasant things to do, I don't know what they are. I'm in the joke. For a sannyasi like me, I can't imagine anything more pleasing than doing this. But most people don't feel the same way as I do, and that's okay. Most people have these ordinary likes and dislikes with regard to worldly activities. I get that. But unless those ragas and dveshas are managed to some degree, you won't meditate, you won't come to class, you won't practice bhakti. All you do is enjoy your life, which is exactly what other animals do. Other animals do. What is the implication? That's right. We are animals. What to say? Okay. Let us continue. Esha vai paramo yogo, esha vai paramo yogo, manasa sangraha smritaha, manasa sangraha smritaha, hridayagnyatvam anvichan, dam yasye varvato muhuhu, dam yasye varvato muhuhu, dam yasya eva arvataha muhuhu. We'll see that a little later. Esha vai vai, indeed, eshaha, this is paramaha yogaha. This is the supreme yoga. Which is the supreme yoga? This is, in fact, here he's doing the same thing he did in the Bhagavad Gita. What is the supreme yoga? Whatever yoga you're teaching at the current time. That's what he does in Bhagavad Gita, and that's what he's doing here. So, esha vai paramaha yogaha. This is the supreme, the highest yoga. What is that? Manasaha sangraha. Control of the mind. Control of the mind, smritaha, is understood to be the highest yoga. And then he gives it, this is a wonderful metaphor in the second half, and very helpful. I'll start in the last line. Damyasya eva arvataha. Arvan is a less common word for horse. You may know horse as ashwa. Ashwa, arvan. So that arvataha, for a horse, who is damyasya, who is under control, being controlled, eva is the word that sneaks in there, like. Like a horse who is trained or being trained, muhuhu, again and again, a horse that's being trained, he says that a well-trained horse. There's a very nice example he gives in the third line. He said that well-trained horse, anvichan, can discern hridayagnyatvam, we have to get the grammar right here. For that well-trained horse, there is hridayagnyatvam. Gnyatvam, the ability to understand. Hridaya, the heart, the mind, the heart or mind of the rider. Imagine a horse who is so well-trained that and this is true, a rider just has to shift his or her weight a little bit, one way like this or one way like that, or look one way or something. And then horse reads the mind, metaphorically, of the rider and goes that way. Are horses automatically like that? They have to be trained. Think about a person with an untrained horse. Now, I don't think any of us have had this experience. We can imagine an untrained horse. First of all, that untrained horse, you can't even ride. In fact, you have to be careful that untrained horse is ready to trample you, right? So the first step is to establish some kind of relationship with that untrained horse to quiet it down. this is a metaphor for meditation. A completely untrained horse can trample you. A completely untrained mind can metaphorically trample you. So first step is make friends with the horse. Make friends with your mind. Seriously. Some people make the mistake of turning the mind into an enemy. People who constantly criticize themselves. The term used here is self-deprecation. I'm an idiot. I'm no good. Why did I do that? Why do I keep doing that? That's turning your mind into an enemy, and it's harmful. If you take out a whip on that horse, if that's your first step to train the horse, how is that going to go? Do you think you're ever going to get on that horse's back if you start whipping it? In the same way, self-deprecation is like metaphorically whipping ourselves. What an idiot I am. What a jerk. Why did I do that? Every one of those are a verbal whip, a verbal self-injury, verbal self-insult. Your mind is not your enemy. And to learn to control your mind and improve the mind, the first step is befriending your mind in spite of its problems. The mind, all of you have a friend who's got some problems, right? What do you do with your friend? Do you say, you shouldn't be like that? Is that how you handle your friend? You understand your friend's problems. And then you help your friend with the problems. You accept the problems first, correct? So this is how we handle our minds. We say, okay, my mind is like that. I can deal with that. That kind of acceptance and a little bit of positivity about dealing with it. So you start on the horse. You start by making friends with the horse. You don't use a whip. And pretty soon you can get on the horse. And then you've got these reins, and you can pull on. I think when I was a kid, I was on a horse at least once or twice. I have no idea, don't remember any of this, but I think you can pull on the left rein and pulls the horse's head around, and then the horse's body follows, something like that. And similarly, the right rein. So you control the horse with the reins. You can pull back and make the horse slow down, things like that. So in this way, the rider conveys his or her intention to the horse. And this is an intermediate stage of taking care of our minds. And that is, we need some reins. What are the reins? In fact, in the Katha Upanishad and elsewhere, it says the reins are the buddhi, the intellect. Actually, other ways of understanding it as well. So you use your intellect. Interesting, we have the metaphor. You rein in your mind. Perfect metaphor. So how do you rein in your mind? With your will. You willfully and deliberately rein in your mind. This is an intermediate step of meditation. For example, you're meditating, your mind wanders. What do? You willfully and deliberately catch your mind as it's wandering away and bring your mind back to the meditation practice. And you do this again and again, just like with the horse. The training is not a one-time event. It's again and again the horse is trained, so too for the mind. Again and again, you bring your mind back to the meditation. This is willful control of the mind, which is an intermediate step. What Sri Krishna describes here is a higher step. It is a well-trained mind is like a well-trained horse that doesn't need to be controlled by the reins. A really well-trained horse can intuit the rider's intention. As I said, maybe they shift their weight, or maybe it's whatever they do. Or maybe they've ridden the same path 100 times before, so the horse already knows the path to be followed. So this highly trained horse represents a highly trained mind. How do you get there? Muhuhu, again and again and again. How long does it take to train a horse? Not a day or two. I have no idea, but I would imagine it's months or maybe years to train a horse. So how long does it take to train a mind? That's a good starting point, months to years. Honestly, I think, for most people, that's a fair range. You'll get something accomplished in several months, but after several years of concerted effort, you will have a well-trained mind. Nice metaphor. Then, where are we there? Now we get a specific meditation technique. Sankhyena sarva bhavanam, Sankhyena sarva bhavanam, pratilomanulomataha, pratilomanulomataha, bhavapyayavanudhyayan, bhavapyayavanudhyayen, mano yavat prasidati, manaha yavat prasidati. The mind is calmed, the mind is quieted through this particular spiritual practice. And what Sri Krishna gives in the first 3 lines of this verse is actually a very sophisticated practice. This isn't an introductory practice at all. So he presumes, I suppose, that Uddhava has had prior meditation, excuse me, prior meditation practices. Perhaps we can assume that. So what Sri Krishna offers us here is quite an important but not a beginning practice. Start in the third line. He says, bhava apyayao, you have to break the words properly, bhava apyayao anudhyayet, if we break the words all properly, dhyayet, one should meditate. Anudhyayet, one should continually meditate. Anudhyayet, maybe contemplate, observe would be better for this, anudhyayet. One should observe, that's a better translation, anudhyayet. One should observe bhava and apyaya. Bhava means the rising of a thought. Apyaya means the dissolution of a thought. This is a very sophisticated technique to observe the rise and fall of thoughts. And it's a sophisticated technique because you have to pay attention. You can't be paying attention to anything else except the rise and fall of your thoughts. So in other words, a lot of prior practice is required to prepare you for this technique, so your mind is not engaged in any other activity at all. You are simply observing. And what are you observing? Ha, there's a thought. Ha, there's another one. Oh, look, that one's going away without the verbal. There's no... I'm just doing that to illustrate, but the self-talk is not going on. It's wordless observation of the rise and fall of thoughts. Now, and that's only part of the technique. That's already sophisticated, and that's only part of the technique because he says that you should observe the rise and fall of your thoughts. How? Up in the first line, he says, sankhyena, with the knowledge or understanding that comes from Sankhya. Sankhya here just means knowledge in general, spiritual knowledge in particular. Jnanena, Sankhyena, sarva bhavanam, with your understanding of all things. What kind of sarva bhavanam, of all things? So by understanding that all things that exist undergo pratiloma and anuloma. And again, meaning depends on context. Anuloma means to come into existence. Pratiloma is a reverse, to go out of existence. Understanding, so the first half means you should, to paraphrase this whole three-line section, you should observe the rise and fall of your thoughts with the understanding that everything that exists arises from an underlying substratum and resolves into that underlying substratum. This is Sankhya. This is spiritual understanding. And that makes this technique even more sophisticated. You don't just merely observe the rise and fall of your thoughts, but you observe the rise and fall of thoughts with this particular understanding that thoughts, like everything else, arise from an underlying reality and then resolve into that underlying reality, like the entire universe. These terms, pratiloma and anuloma, are sometimes used to refer to the creation and dissolution of the universe. There's an anuloma prakriya. There's a method of development. The world comes into existence from what? So here, if we draw upon some of the profound teachings of Advaita Vedanta, everything exists because of Brahman. And then the universe exists, and then the universe undergoes dissolution. But dissolution doesn't mean passing into utter non-existence. It means returning to the source. The example we give is this pot came from clay, and eventually, when it gets broken and crushed, it'll return to clay. So notice that the pot never becomes utterly non-existent. It arises from clay, it returns to clay, and in the meanwhile, it has the nama rupa, the name and form of pot. So this is the status given to your thoughts. Like the pot arises from clay, your thoughts, or like the universe arises from Brahman, your thoughts arise from, we have to use the right word now, your thoughts don't arise from clay. There's no this. You may feel that way sometimes. No clay. And Brahman is not the right word to use here. Consciousness, chit, chaitanya. Your thoughts arise from consciousness. Your thoughts return to consciousness. This is a sophisticated meditation technique Sri Krishna gives here. And I find this particularly surprising because the emphasis of the entire Bhagavata Purana is bhakti. And look at this. In the midst of this text, dedicated to cultivating bhakti, we have this profound verse on a sophisticated kind of meditation. So let's summarize that, because you might want to practice this at home, or maybe in a few, maybe next week we'll practice. Yeah, I'll make a note. We'll practice this technique here next week. In our meditation session, and it's sophisticated, but you can handle it. So, what is the technique? And what we'll do next week is this. We'll do something to make our minds fairly quiet, and then we'll observe the rising and falling of a thought. The thought will be Om. Om arises in the mind. Om fades. Om arises. Om fades. That's step one. Actually, it's step two. Step one is to prepare the mind. Step two is to observe the rise and fall of Om. Step three is to appreciate that this Om is rising from consciousness. This Om is returning to consciousness, the consciousness which is your essential nature as Satchidananda Atma. So this is a technique, and hopefully I won't forget. We'll do this technique in next week's class. Okay. Next. Nirvinasya viraktasya Nirvinasya viraktasya Purushas yokta vedinaha Purushas yokta vedinaha Manas tyajati daurayatmam Manas tyajati dauratmyam Chintitas yanu chintaya. Second line, purushasya, for a person. What kind of person? First line, nirvinasya, for a person who is nirvinna, is often used for depressed. We've used it in a spiritual context. Disillusioned is good. Disillusioned in this, usually disillusioned does mean kind of depressed, but in this context, disillusioned here means to recognize that perfect peace and contentment will never, ever be found through worldly activities, worldly efforts. That's a big disillusionment. You know, we all start off in life thinking, wow, look at what, especially when we get in our, maybe in our 20s is a good time for this. You think, wow, look at all the things I can do. The world is, what is that? I don't understand that expression. The world is my oyster. What in the world does that mean? I have no idea. But that's an expression that's used. The world is available to me. What a, like a playground. Let's go have some fun. And then you go have some fun and discover, and you get kicked around quite a bit and discover that it's not all that great. And eventually you discover that perfect contentment, lasting peace will never, ever be found through your worldly efforts. That is this condition here called nirvinna, to be disillusioned. And along with that, you become virakta, you become detached. You are no longer driven by raga dvesha to chase after all those goodies in the world. We've taken these two words together previously to talk about a kind of conversion, not a, you know, you've heard of religious conversions and so forth. This is not a religious conversion, but rather a conversion of intent, wherein originally your intent was to gain contentment through worldly activities. Then when you discover that's impossible, there's a conversion. And the conversion is, instead of seeking contentment through worldly effort, you seek perfect contentment through spiritual practice. That's a conversion. So instead of worldly effort, you're now focused on spiritual practice. So for such a person who has recognized the limitations of what can be accomplished through worldly activities, a person who is virakta, who has become detached from all of that, recognizing the limitations, for that person who is, in the second line end, who is ukta vedinaha, the person who is, who vedinaha, the person who understands what has been ukta taught, and the commentator makes it very clear, guru upadishta. The commentator says, the one who has been taught properly by one's guru. So the one who has understood what the guru has taught, which is crucial to put that spiritual practice in the right direction. Many times spiritual practice goes off in some really, I don't know how else to put it, weird directions. I was watching a video about Krishnamurti. Amazing story. If you don't know his story, it's something amazing. Anyway, there was this little boy, Jiddu, is walking with his little brother on a beach in Chennai, in those days, Madras. And this lead beater sees this boy. And according to this video, he saw an aura. This boy was shining. Huh? The boy was, radioactive? Or there's another explanation. I still remember this. Visiting, actually, and it was that Mamallapuram is just north of Chennai. It's a very beautiful temple town. And there was a phosphorescent sea when we were there. And if you've seen that, it is the most amazing thing, because these little, I think they're algae, that glow blue or blue-green when they're agitated. And so the waves glow. And when they crash on shore, they glow. So I suppose this young Jiddu had drunk enough of that algae. I'm being pretty silly. But my point is this, and I don't want to sound too critical, but this is the origins of the Theosophical Society that were so focused on these paranormal things, paranormal activities, like people who glowed with auras, like ancient sages that could speak to you. This is mainstream Theosophical Society teachings. This is Olcott and Leadbeater and later Ani Besant and all of this stuff. This is what they believed in. And to me, that's evidence of the spiritual path taking a twist, and an unhelpful twist. Of course, you know the story of Jiddu, of this boy Jiddu, who grew up to become the famous J.K., J. Krishnamurti, who then repudiated the entire Theosophical Society and said, "You're all nuts." He did not exactly that, but he turned his back on the organization. They trained him. He turned his back on them. So because he knew, they took this detour. So, and that's the point I'm making here, and that is, unless you have proper guidance, there are many things that can lead to detours. A good common example is to meditate and have some kind of amazing experience. And that sounds really good on the surface, unless you don't have a guru to warn you. A guru who to warn you that wonderful experiences in meditation are great, but don't let that experience become your goal. Because some people get stuck on trying to duplicate an experience they had in meditation. And that's a huge error, and that's an easily prevented error, but it's an error that anyone can easily make if you don't have proper guidance. And that's this word here, ukta vedinaha, for a person who has proper guidance, who's not going to go on some kind of spiritual detour. What about that person in the last line? chintitasya, for that person who goes on thinking about all this, anuchintaya, through that person's constant reflection, constant means constant. It means not just on Saturday mornings. You get that. So constant means this becomes embedded in our lives, embedded in our thinking. And that's crucial because in order to come out of this dense, in Mandukya Upanishad, I forget where, it says not just ignorance, dense ignorance. If you think of ignorance as being like blackness, imagine blackness being physical. Imagine blackness, you had to cut it with a knife in order to get through the blackness. That's the metaphor here of dense ignorance. In order to shake off this dense ignorance that afflicts us, it's going to take significant effort, not just Saturday mornings. So therefore, anuchintaya, through this constant reflection. And third line, manaha tyajati daura atmyam. Manaha, mind, tyajati, gets rid of, overcomes, daura atmyam. Daura atmyam means here weakness. Has other meanings as well, but weakness, difficulties here. So the weakness or difficulty of the mind, I mentioned before, that dense ignorance is overcome with this constant effort. Okay. We'll see one more verse. All right. Yamadi bhir yoga patar, yamadi bhir yoga patar, anvikshikya cha vidyaya, anvikshikya cha vidyaya, mamarchopasana bhirva, mamarchopasana bhirva, nanyar yogyam smaren manaha, nanyar yogyam smaren manaha. Start in the second line. Vidyaya, through knowledge. The sneak preview of this verse, by the way, is remember we said that Sri Krishna puts jnana, spiritual wisdom, and bhakti, devotion, up on a higher tier. And then karma yoga and dhyana, meditation, are preparatory to both, for both jnana yoga and bhakti yoga. And that's the topic here. So he says, vidyaya, through knowledge. What kind of knowledge? Anvikshikya. Knowledge which is based on self-inquiry. It just means inquiry, reflection here. But self-inquiry. We've said, you've heard me say, probably, that Vedanta is, in essence, a process of self-inquiry. Atma vichara. If you want to understand Vedanta in a most simplified sense, there's so much more to Vedanta, but in essence, it is a practice of self-inquiry. Here, anvikshi. Excuse me. So, through wisdom associated with this process of self-inquiry. He's talking about that path of jnana, path of spiritual wisdom, which is yamadi bihi yoga pataihi, which you find on yoga pata, on the path of yoga, which includes yamadi bihi. Yama, niyama are the first of those eight limbs of Patanjali's yoga. So here he's making reference to dhyana, meditation. So this yoga pata, Which yoga are we talking about? What are the last several verses about? They're about dhyana, meditation. Remember, yoga can mean so many things, and even as a spiritual practice. Which yoga are we talking about? So in the first line, the yoga he's referring to is meditation, dhyana. So vidyaya, through spiritual wisdom, which is associated with self-inquiry, and it is gained through preparation by means of dhyana, meditation. Now here's the trick. Then in the third line, mama archa upasibihi va. Va, or. So he says, vidyaya, through spiritual wisdom, va, or, mama archa upasanabihi, or through upasanabihi, meditation on mama archa, on my divine form. You won't find that in the Bhagavad Gita. This is one of the uniquenesses of this text. You get it, he makes the choice very clear. Actually, in the beginning, if you want to make a comparison, go home and read the first half of chapter 12. First half of chapter 12, you get a somewhat similar. You can do this. If you can't do this, very nice. This is the opening part of chapter 12, a paraphrase. Sri Krishna says, do this. And then he says, well, if you can't do this, do that. Then he says, well, if you can't do that either, then do this. And then he finally concludes, well, if you can't do any of that, at least practice karma yoga. This is the opening part of chapter 12, a little bit like this. So here he gives you a choice. He says, he says, to see what you can do, look at the last line. Yogyam smaret manaha. You should make your mind dwell. Manaha yogyam. Make your mind dwell controlled. Make your mind controlled in context. You should. Context is dhyana, meditation. So you should control your mind. How? He gives two options here. He says that dhyana, which is for the control of the mind, is either associated with vidya in the third line, in the second line, va, or that meditation is associated with mama archa upasana, meditation on my form, bhakti. Now, just to make this very, the words are a little bit complicated, the meaning is clear. There are two, Sri Krishna here is describing two parallel paths, jnana and bhakti. Both of these paths culminate in the same realization of your true nature as Satchidananda Atma, which Sri Krishna describes as his own presence within you, the so-called inner divinity. The point he's making in this verse is that for these two, jnana and bhakti, both of them need preparation, and the preparation for both is dhyana. So he says that your practice of meditation can lead either in the direction of spiritual wisdom, or your practice of meditation can lead in the direction of bhakti. So dhyana, meditation, can prepare you for spiritual wisdom. The same dhyana, meditation, can prepare you for bhakti. And that word va is very significant. He's giving you a choice. And I find this particularly refreshing because, the conventional idea about religion in general is you don't get a choice. This is what you have to do. Do it this way, do it right, or get out. Religions of the world are not generally known as giving you lots of options. Here, we have an option. If your main practice is actually there's, in one way, there's no option. Because he says, if your main practice is gaining spiritual wisdom, he says, meditate. If your main practice is cultivating bhakti, he says, meditate. So with regard to meditation, there's no choice. You need it regardless. If your main focus is jnana or your main focus is bhakti, you need it in both ways. In this way, yogyam manaha smaret. In this way, you can control your mind. Na anyaihi. And this actually contradicts what I just said. Na anyaihi, not by any other means, directly contradicts what I just said. You get a choice. You do get a choice, and if you're going to focus more on bhakti or jnanam, but when it comes to dhyana, meditation, and we can add in karma yoga as well, he says, na anyaihi, there's no choice there. If you do not gain the necessary preparation through karma yoga and dhyana, meditation, any other spiritual practice you undertake for the sake of gaining spiritual wisdom or for the sake of cultivating bhakti, those practices will not be effective if you have failed to properly prepare yourself through karma yoga and through meditation. Na anyaihi, in that regard, there's no choice. You need to prepare yourself. You must be a prepared student. We sometimes use the term adhikari in a Vedantic sense here. You have to be a prepared student. Simply put, you have to be ready. It's that simple. If you're not ready, the spiritual practice will not be fruitful. Okay, this is a good place to stop. We'll continue this next week. Tomorrow, Sunday, we have our usual Vedanta class tomorrow at 10 o'clock, followed by satsang, question and answer, at 11. If you're coming, please remember that the clock changes tomorrow. Daylight savings time comes to an end, so make sure that you come at the right time. We'll conclude with our prayers.